together to order, excuse me, at 1:07 p.m. Today is Wednesday, January 18th. Members present are Representative Chris Birch, Representative Harriet Drummond, Representative Justin Parrish, Representative George Rauscher, Representative Dave Tallarico, Vice Chair Dean Westlake, Co-Chair Andy Josephson, and myself. We had Representative Johnson for our earlier meeting, so I hope she'll be back to join us here momentarily. So please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to do business. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Deborah Dillinghast, and our LIO moderators, Greg Payne and Ben Manley. Before we start the update on the AKLNG project, could I please ask members to silence your cell phones? And we're joined by Representative Johnson here at 1:08. So today's meeting is going to be our statutorily required update on the AKLNG project. I think my staff is passing out a document with a few relevant sections that I want to point out to members before we start our update. Of course, some of the members here are new to the legislature as well as new to the committee, so just want to give you a couple of things to refer back to, and the handout are some of these key sections, and I think now that's been distributed to everyone's desk. We can also put this on basis if there are individuals who are watching and are interested in this. If you look to the last sections of the bill, and I think the handout has them in order, so it's on the last page, it's section 77 of the bill that requires legislative briefings, and it requires that these briefings be done at least every, I want to say, 4 months. And so that's the briefing that we'll be having here today, and you can see the parameters of that briefing. I want to also point out a couple of other sections of the bill that may be of interest. In section 7, this is where we amended the bill, responsibilities of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation to give them broad authority to work on an AKLNG project as envisioned from that bill and even the form it's in going forward today. And so I would just point members to Section 7 just for review of that. And if you look at the bill on basis, you'll see, you know, the highlighted sections are the amended portion of the statute. So if you remember, prior to Senate Bill 138's passage, AGDC had just been empowered to work on an in-state gas line. So what we did in this bill was give them broad authority, and that's been something that's come up as we've sort of transitioned and reviewed what's happening. I also want to point out that also at the end of the bill, section 75 is the section of the bill that directs ADA and the Alaska Energy Authority to work on a report for us related to distribution for areas that wouldn't otherwise be served by an AKLNG project, so essentially off the road system in rural areas, and that'll be the subject of Wednesday's presentation with Mr. Terrio. So those are a few of the relevant sections of the bill. Of course, it's all important. I would recommend for any member having not been on the committee to please go back and review. There are, in addition to the section that talks specifically about the AKLNG project, there are some additional changes to make to the AGDC. For example, if there are contractual obligations made or if there is work done on behalf of the state, AGDC can't overcharge the state. So some particulars like that may be of interest. And then some of the middle portion of the bill really talks about the responsibilities of the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources as well as the Commissioner of Department of Revenue, and it's very intertwined relationship between AGDC and these two commissioners, and talks about the sort of gives the parameters of how those conversations will take place and what kind of consultation will happen, and so that may be of interest. And if our offices, the co-chair and myself, having worked on this for a couple of years now, can be a resource in understanding Senate Bill 138, please reach out, and we'd love to sit down and go over that or answer any questions. So before we transition into our presentation, just want to make sure members don't have any questions about those sections that have been referenced. Okay. We'll begin our AKLNG update from hearing from the producers, and so I believe we have members, representatives from our what we will still call our partner businesses here with us today, and you all, I think, have determined among yourselves who might like to come to the table first, and then they'll be followed by presentation from the state and talk about that transition in responsibility for management of the project. So please join us at the table, and whoever wants to be on the hot seat first.
Co-Chair Tarr, Co-Chair Josephson, members of the House Resources Committee. For the record, my name is Bill McMahon. I'm a senior commercial advisor, and I have over 34 years of experience with ExxonMobil, and I've worked on commercializing Alaska natural gas since 1992. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to address the committee this afternoon. My testimony is going to be given in two parts. The first part is going to be on behalf of the Alaska LNG project, or AKLNG, as we like to call it. It's going to be on behalf of the four participants, AGDC, ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips. These four parties have worked hard to complete the technical and regulatory handover and the commercial transition of AKLNG to a state LNG project run by AGDC. And I'll be sharing our progress since September. The second part of my testimony will be ExxonMobil's perspectives on a state LNG project and how our company is supporting this AGDC effort. Following my testimony, Damian Bilbao and Darren Mesnerich will be sharing BP and ConocoPhillips perspectives, respectively. As always, we look forward to answering your questions. So following the administration's decision to pursue a state LNG project, ExxonMobil is lead party under the pre-FEED JVA, that is Joint Venture Agreement, completed an extensive handover process with AGDC with all the pre-FEED JVA work products, including the underlying technical data. In addition, on behalf of the applicants in the FERC pre-filing, ExxonMobil also met with regulators and AGDC to discuss the coming changes. On January the 4th, the FERC was advised by letter that ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips have withdrawn from the pre-file docket, leaving AGDC as the sole applicant. So during testimony back on August the 25th, the key components of the technical and regulatory handover and the commercial transition were shared. And so today, what I'd like to do is list the accomplishments since that time. All 77 of the pre-FEED deliverables agreed under the AKLNG Joint Venture Agreement are finished and have been distributed to AGDC, ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips. The final two draft resource reports, that's number 11 and number 13, were submitted by the applicants to FERC, completing the draft resource reports acquired to advance the EIS pre-file process. FERC and the other coordinating agencies have provided over 2,700 comments on the 12 resource reports that were submitted, and the AKLNG project team has provided a summary of all these comments and questions to all the parties, including AGDC. The AKLNG project team completed dozens of project technical and regulatory handover sessions with AGDC, including weekly sessions and extended workshops. These handover sessions, which were completed prior to year-end 2016, provided a smooth and efficient handover of the activities to AGDC for a state LNG project. AGDC is now positioned to take the full responsibility for the technical and regulatory aspects of their project. Agreements were executed prior to year-end as part of the commercial transition from AKLNG to the state LNG project. These agreements provided for the use of historical and pre-FEED data and information by all the pre-FEED JVA parties for any project, including a state LNG project. Work continues on agreements for AGDC to acquire ownership of an LLC held by ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips affiliates, and to provide interim access to some of its assets. The LLC owns land in Nikiski and the DOE export authorizations. So before I move to the ExxonMobil comments, I'll pause and see if there's any questions about the AK LNG accomplishments in 2016.
Just before you go on, I will point out that Senate Bill 138 in Section 19 is what allows for formation of some of these subsidiaries, and so this very one was formed previously without participation from the state. This is the one that you're referring to will be transferred over, right?
Co-Chair Tarr, that's correct.
Thank you.
Okay, well, I'm going to change hats, and now I'm going to share ExxonMobil's perspectives on a state LNG project and how our company is supporting the AGDC effort. As you know, one of the motivations for the administration to assume control of the project was to assess the potential advantages that may only be available to a state project. These potential advantages, as expressed by the administration, include reducing the cost of supply through tax-exempt project structure, and using low-cost funds from third-party investors willing to take a utility rate return on a government-backed project. Both of these opportunities could potentially make a significant reduction in the cost of supply for Alaska LNG, as highlighted in a Wood Mackenzie study commissioned by AGDC, BP, and ExxonMobil, and as was presented to this committee by David Barrowman of WoodMac back on August the 24th. Cost of supply is a key measure of competitiveness in the global LNG market. In addition to opportunities to reduce cost of supply, a state-backed LNG project also has the potential to reduce regulatory risk through government-to-government cooperation. ExxonMobil wants a project to succeed and is willing to pursue all commercially viable alternatives to develop Alaska resources on mutually agreed terms. While AGDC is now responsible for advancing a state LNG project, ExxonMobil will still have a major role in the development of Alaska North Slope natural gas. First, through continued development at Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson, and second, by making our gas available for sale for the project. To date, the producers have invested billions of dollars at Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson to successfully develop these fields. Investments continue at these fields to support the ongoing operations. ExxonMobil will continue to make its gas available to any project under bilaterally, mutually agreed, commercially reasonable terms. In 2015, when Governor Walker sought assurances from each of the producers about gas availability, ExxonMobil immediately formed a negotiating team, executed confidentiality agreements with the administration, and had several preliminary meetings. With the completion of the handover to a state LNG project, ExxonMobil remains ready to reengage on negotiations for gas sales and purchase agreements. These commercial and fiscal terms will need to be predictable and durable, so all parties involved, including potential buyers and financiers, understand the underlying framework, particularly given the magnitude of the required investments and commitments, which are measured over decades. So in closing, ExxonMobil wants to help make the state LNG project successful. We're pleased to have participated in a successful handover from AK LNG to AGDC. We're committed to work through the completion of the required LLC transactions, and we're ready to restart bilateral discussions on purchasing ExxonMobil gas from Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson for a state project. And lastly, ExxonMobil looks forward to the progress a state LNG project will make. If AGDC can adequately achieve cost reductions, secure regulatory approvals, advance through the project gates to a final investment decision, and complete project execution and construction, everyone will benefit. So before I turn the microphone over to Mr. Bilbao of BP, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. McMahon. And if you could please provide that written testimony to our office, then we'll distribute that via basis for members as well as interested parties. Representative Birch.
Thank you, through the chair, Mr. McMahon, for your testimony and your comments. You know, for many of us, this project is intensely personal. It's personal for ourselves and our children. I guess, you know, from a personal standpoint, is this a project that you would commit, say, shall we say half of your personal net worth to invest in? I mean, how do you see this as a project? Because that's basically the question that's in front of us right now.
Representative Birch, through the chair, that is why ExxonMobil uses a stage gate approach to mega projects, because we are staking large sums of money to advance a project. Pre-FEED, for example, cost the four participants over $500 million. And so the way you can advance projects with confidence is to go through a disciplined stage gate process. As risks are reduced, you can expose more and more capital. But ExxonMobil wants to do what it can to help this project be commercially viable.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. McMahon? Okay, well, thank you. And we have Mr. Balboa next. Thank you.
Thank you. Co-Chair Tarr, Co-Chair Josephson, members of the House Resources Committee. For the record, my name is Damian Bilbao, and I appreciate the opportunity and invitation to be here today. I'll start by acknowledging that reading through prepared testimony is not the most elegant or easy way to walk through this conversation. So as we go through it, if you could help me out by asking the questions and seeking clarification where it's appropriate, that'll probably work out better off. So thanks in advance for helping me out. I am the Vice President of Commercial Ventures for BP here in Alaska. I first arrived in Alaska to work for ARCO Alaska as an intern a few years ago. Fell in love with this state, and my family and I have lived here in Alaska for almost 10 years with interruptions for some overseas assignments. I'd like to first follow Bill's remarks by recognizing the great work done by the joint project team under ExxonMobil's leadership. Steve Butt and the team delivered exactly what they were asked to do when the pre-FEED JVA was signed and then some. They did that work safely, professionally, on schedule, and on budget, and BP thanks them for that. My responsibilities within BP include Alaska LNG, our North Slope fields operated by other companies, as well as our interest in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And I'd like to pause and recognize that along with Prudhoe Bay, TAPS is celebrating a 40-year anniversary this year. I would also like to recognize that this past December 18th, Alaska celebrated the 45th anniversary of the signing of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Without the tremendous support and license from Alaska's Native communities, the state would have a much different history. I would ask that as we discuss Alaska LNG today, we remember that this state only has the luxury of discussing Alaska LNG project because of cooperation shown in establishing the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Ensuring another 40 years of economic security for Alaska will require collaboration and finding common ground. It is for this reason the future economic health of Alaska and BP's participation in that opportunity that BP continues to support an Alaska LNG project led by the state of Alaska. BP's support derives from three important beliefs. First, the resource opportunity in Alaska is strong. The talent is deep, and there is a history of coming together to fix big problems. Secondly, the demand for LNG will continue to grow in Northeast Asia beyond 2025, and much of that growth will come from players like China. Third, Alaska LNG can compete for that growing demand. As was shown in the Wood Mackenzie study, which Bill referred to earlier, and presented before the legislature in August 2016, certain non-technical solutions are required for that competitiveness to be achieved. BP believes that the state is positioned through AGDC to lead this commercial effort in three focus areas. First, the competitiveness of a tolling model where gas owners pay a utility-like company to transport their gas to the Cook Inlet, liquefy the gas, and load it onto ships. Secondly, preserve the federal regulatory schedule, because failure to do so could add years to the schedule and impact the reputation of the project. And third, identify options to fund both the next phase of the project, front-end engineering and design, or FEED, as well as the most financially demanding phase, construction, which would occur after a final investment decision, or FID. Now, BP does not believe these three areas will require contracting with large companies to begin the process of purchasing pipe or steel, but rather will require deep analysis by subject matter experts familiar with commercial aspects of an LNG business. Now, while BP supports a state-led project, we believe it is also important for BP to do more than sit back and wait for AGDC to answer these three questions. BP must actively support AGDC. I'm very pleased to share with you that AGDC and BP have signed a cooperation agreement that will bring together our efforts and resources on the three focus areas that I outlined previously. First, assessing the tolling model. Second, preserving regulatory progress. And third, identifying financing options for the path forward. BP is committing people and funding to this joint effort. Although it will be an effort led by a much smaller group of people than completed the pre-FEED deliverables, which Bill McMahon just summarized. BP appreciates AGDC's commitment to working together, and we look forward to updating the legislature over the course of the year. This is an important year for BP in Alaska, and we look forward to celebrating the anniversary of Prudhoe Bay and TAP's first 40th anniversary. While BP has worked with our co-owners to produce over 12 billion barrels of oil from Prudhoe Bay, there are still billions more in Prudhoe and across the North Slope. As the governor's chief advisor on oil and gas, John Hendricks, said during his recent speech at Meet Alaska on January 13th, we must all pursue our future as one Alaska. BP agrees. It is only as one Alaska that the state will continue to solve big problems. BP looks forward to continuing to work with this legislature, the administration, Alaska's native corporations, our contractors, and our upstream co-venturers in support of a one Alaska future. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bilbao. Any questions for the BP presentation? Okay. Well, then we will go to our next presenter. And if you could please state your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Darren Mesnerich, and I am the ConocoPhillips manager for Alaska North Slope Gas. Recognizing my colleagues' comments addressed many of my comments, I'm going to be brief. As we have said in the past, ConocoPhillips is supportive of the state's effort to try and move a project forward. We support a state-led project because there are certain things that only the state can do, which will make an ANS gas project more competitive and lower its cost of supply. AGDC has discussed these as key elements in their plan. First, structuring for federal and state tax efficiencies, including seeking federal tax-exempt status, and we think this could be a significant opportunity, and we support AGDC pursuing this. Also, advancing low-cost financing and investor options. These key elements could be foundational to a competitive project, even in this price environment. And they could provide a compelling story to LNG buyers, project lenders, and investors. As we've said before, we intend to make our gas available to a state-led project on mutually agreed, commercially reasonable terms. In summary, we are continuing to support AGDC as it executes this plan. We are working to make our gas available and taking other steps so the state and AGDC and other parties can go forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr.
Mesnerich?
Mesnerich, thank you. I'm realizing I'm going to have to practice names here before committee. Representative Birch.
Have there been any forecasts or estimates in this for anybody in the panel of what a range would be for a tariff for gas? Obviously, it depends on volume, but I'm just trying to get to the point of you're at Tidewater in South Central Alaska. What's the tariff to get it from where the product exists in the North Slope to South Central? And it's probably embedded in here someplace. But do you have a sense of what that tariff is per MCF, depending on the structure?
Go ahead. Yes.
Representative Birch, through the chair, there have been no joint efforts to define a tariff. I think in the current context of a AGDC-led project, that might be an appropriate question directed to them, and I expect that you will find there is some work that will need to be done before that question can be answered. If it goes fundamentally to what is the structure, what is the financing, the steps that I laid out very much set out a sequence of work that needs to be done before we get into some of those more difficult, maybe more interesting conversations that will need to take place after that.
Great. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, just building on what Damian said, I believe some of the slides that AGTC is going to present reference the Wood Mackenzie study that was referenced by my colleagues from August, so that might be something you want to look at. It includes some aspirational targets for cost reduction, so that's a good sense.
Great. Okay. Thanks so much.
And before you leave the table, do any of you have any thing you'd like to add to your testimony related to your relationship with the state on this project going forward, or any kind of how that work might be facilitated, any agreements you might be entering into or anything like that?
Madam Chair, Darren Mesrich, ConocoPhillips, we had signed an MOU last fall with the state, so we look forward to continuing to work with the state, just as BP has indicated, to try and help move the project forward. So we continue to work with AGDC periodically, and we'll continue to do so.
And just could you briefly, for new members, give a little bit of detail to that MOU?
This was an MOU, an MOU which was targeting potentially forming a joint venture for LNG marketing, and also to try and resolve the longstanding gas supply issues.
Thank you. Mr. Bilbao.
Madam Co-Chair, so the next step for us is sitting down with AGDC to work through some additional level of detail behind the cooperation agreement we framed up, specific work areas with more detail, and I think we've provided the committee with a copy of that agreement, and we'd be happy to answer any additional questions or come back and discuss that further. We think Exxon's done a great job of leading in the technical space. You've heard what ConocoPhillips is doing on the marketing space, and we believe that there's some specific areas that BP can step in and help to support this state project. And I think the key thing will be is it is about what is the next step, not what are the next four or five steps. We need to take these one at a time and make sure we have the right information before we take the step beyond that.
Thank you. Mr. McMahon.
Co-Chair Tarr, for the record, Bill McMahon, ExxonMobil. We're keen now that the handover and transition are complete to restart discussions about ExxonMobil's gas being made available for this project. And so, whether that be with directly with the state of Alaska or through AGDC, we stand ready to start those negotiations so that an important portion of the gas can be made available for the project.
Excellent. Thank you. And I wanted to just have that, again, just as a reminder for folks that even though it's a transition, there's so much work still happening, from the original project sponsors, and give just a sense of that. So MOU, cooperation agreement, and restart of negotiations would be an accurate description of where we stand today. Representative Rauscher, excuse me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to the representative from BP, I believe you mentioned China and the demand coming from there. You also mentioned that we could compete for that. Did you?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, Damian Bilbao for the record. What I said was that we expect demand to continue to grow, that there will be unmet demand from 2025 and beyond. We expect, as we look to Northeast Asia, that we will see a greater growth coming from China than other parts of Northeast Asia.
Thank you for clarifying my understanding. Now, the question is there a point of a time of no return? In other words, if you don't act by a certain date, it's your efforts are futile. That's the same question.
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, Damian Bilbao for the record. We believe the right next step is making sure we have a competitive project. That's mm-hmm. the fundamental and most important aligning feature beyond just ensuring we have the right trust between the parties. But that competitive project is the foundation before we decide how and when to engage the market. So as Wood Mackenzie showed in August, the project today does not compete. That is not about oil price. That's not about gas price. That's about the cost what it costs us to deliver a molecule of gas to Asia and how we do that for less so that we can compete with emerging sources of LNG like the Gulf Coast of the United States. So we need to focus really, when I talk about commercial structure and a financing plan, those are big inputs to really reassessing whether we can lower the cost of supply of Alaska LNG. If we can demonstrate that we can, if we can demonstrate that what Woodmac laid out can be accomplished, then there's a decision to make around moving the project forward and how to go about marketing it.
Any other questions? Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the chair. In the event that the natural gas pipeline does not go forward, do you have a plan to bring your natural gas to market?
Madam Coach, through the chair, Representative Parrish, Alaska gas remains BP's largest undeveloped resource opportunity. It is very important for us to see a successful gas project. We've done a lot of technical work with some great leadership by ExxonMobil and Conoco as well to understand the viability of Alaska LNG project. We believe there are still questions that need to be answered before we determine that this isn't the way forward. And we won't be looking at progressing an alternative until we've answered those questions. If we answer those questions and confirm that this isn't the way forward, we will have to look at alternatives. And we believe, ultimately, our largest undeveloped resource opportunity, just like the state, we'd like to sell that gas. But it has to be competitive, it has to be commercial, just like it needs to be those for the state. So I would suggest we start by answering some of these questions first, and then we'll come back and worry about the alternative once we've done so.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Okay, well, gentlemen, if you would please stay close by in case questions come up after AGDC's presentation. And if I could please call up now, we have Frank Richards, Senior Vice President of Program Management, Lisa Wilcox, Vice President of Commercial and Economics. I know Commissioner Mack is still here, as well as Commissioner Hoffbeck. I don't know. It looks like you're departing us at this moment. Okay. Okay. Well, thanks for the visit. Okay. Wonderful. Thanks for visiting us. And on the phone, we have Keith Meyer, president of AGDC. He's overseas and unable to attend in person, but he has joined us by phone, as well as John Hendricks, the chief oil and gas advisor for the governor. So we are really appreciative of everyone's time. It looks like we also have Donna Keppers, who's deputy commissioner at the Department of Revenue, Fritz Krusen from AGDC, also on the line with us. And so let the moderators know if we need to have any of the folks who are on us joining us by phone and join the conversation, and we'll make sure that they get to join in. Members should have the presentation in their packets, so please, Mr. Richards, if you would, put yourself on the record, and thank you so much for being here today.
Madam Chairman, Tar, Co-Chair Josephson, and members of the committee, my name is Frank Richards. I'm the Senior Vice President for Program Management with the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, and with me today, we have, as you said, Lisa Wilcox, our Vice President of Commercial Management, and we also have Keith Meyer on the telephone. So it might be an appropriate time for Keith to have an opening statement.
Sure. If we could make his line active. Mr. Meyer, welcome to the House Resources Committee. Please put yourself on the record, and we're looking forward to hearing from you.
All right, very good. Thank you. Keith Meyer, President of AGDC. I'm sorry that I can't be there today. I'm currently in Japan on a mission marketing this project. I think we tried to have a convenient schedule so I could be, but unfortunately this trip had been planned, so we were not able to reschedule. But I think we've got a very good presentation that Frank and Lisa will give. I appreciate the comments from each of the producer parties. I think we enjoy a very good and collaborative working relationship with them. So I'm happy to hear their comments and happy to have their support as we move forward. So with that, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Richards.
Madam Chairman, again, thank you for having us here today. I would like to recognize two other people in attendance today. Again, we have Ms. Rosetta Alcantara, who is our Vice President of Communications, back here in the back row. And then we also have a new member of our team. Mr. Gene Theriault has joined AGDC along with his duties with ADA, and he'll be providing us with government relations during this session, and so he'll be a face that you'll see around the halls quite frequently. So it's a great honor to have Gene joining us for this hearing. As you suggested, this is our opportunity as AGDC to be able to present the Section 77 required report to the legislature on an update of the Alaska LNG project. So I would like, if I may, though, to talk about, at least for the new members of the committee, how AGDC came into existence, what the legislature deemed was our responsibilities, and provide then some indication on how we are performing those duties, but then also to recognize the board of directors that were also a part of the legislative mandate that we have, and the resources that those directors bring to AGDC in fulfilling our mission, and then provide then that AKLNG project update specifically to identify how we have transitioned from the previous iteration of the project to today and how we're going to proceed in the future. And then I'll shift over to Ms. Wilcox and provide a commercial update. So if there's any questions also during the session, please feel free. We are here as AGDC, but we also have in the room then representatives from the Department of Natural Resources, Department of Revenue, and I believe online there may be Department of Law with the Attorney General's office. So AGDC was the creation of the Alaska State Legislature. In 2009, there was very large concerns that South Central Alaska would not necessarily have enough natural gas to meet the requirements for power generation and heating. So the legislature looked for ways to be able to make sure that there was going to be a gas source available to meet the needs for the residents of South Central Alaska. So there were talks that were developed to looking at in-state pipeline. There were bills that were proposed by then Representative Hawker and former Speaker Chenault, along with Senator McGuire, that culminated in 2010 in House Bill 369, which really created the entity that became the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, and it was a four-party entity with Alaska Housing Finance, Department of Transportation, the Alaska Railroad, and ANGDA, and they gave us the charge to look at whether or not there was the opportunity or if it was possibly economically viable to develop an in-state line to be able to meet the needs of Alaska. So we were created and provided funding to be able to go forth and develop a plan to represent back to the legislature whether or not that line was going to be potentially viable. So in 2011, that plan was developed and presented to the legislature. And again, the legislature at that time saw fit to be able to ask the Alaska Gas Line Corporation to be able to go forward and identify what the needs were going to be to do that. So in 2013, the legislature, through House Bill 4, gave extraordinary powers to the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, created it as an independent state corporation, relieved us from a lot of the process that you find in state departments to act as a corporation, to be able to advance a project.
and funded us with approximately $355 million to be able to advance that effort. So we launched, and we went into what is known as pre-FEED, or pre-front end in engineering and design for the ASAP project, and then advanced into the FEED, or front-end engineering and design for that project, which culminated then in a Class 3 cost estimate and a project execution plan. In 2014, as the partners that you previously heard from in the state of Alaska were looking towards an export project, then the legislature, through Senate Bill 369, gave authorities again to AGDC to act as the state's representative at that initial phase, solely for the LNG plant portion of the Alaska LNG project. Subsequently, in 2015, with the buyout of TransCanada, who was representing the state in the gas treatment plant and pipeline portion of the project for the state, AGDC was then given the full authority to act as the state's full 25% representative with the other joint venture partners that you just heard from.
Mr. Richards, I believe the last reference you meant to say SB 138 when you said HB 369, so I just want to clarify that.
You are correct, Madam Chairman. Senate Bill 138 was the enabling legislation. So as you've heard, there was a joint venture agreement in the initiation of work for the pre-front end engineering for the Alaska LNG project, and that was in 2014. We now find ourselves in 2017 at the tail end of that effort, and with the agreement termination that our producer partners and AGDC enacted at the end of the year, that responsibility for the Alaska LNG project now falls to AGDC. So we understand that that is a very large burden and a tremendous amount of responsibility that has been given to us to advance this project, and we take that responsibility to heart every day. So, if I find in my presentation that I'm using acronyms that you're unfamiliar with, please call me out on it, and I will try and represent what we're talking about when we say JVA or FEED. So, quickly, to our board of directors, we have a 7-member board. We have board representation here today with Commissioner Drygas. But what we have here is our Alaskans that take the mission that they were handed in their responsibilities extremely important. And they bring their energy and their expertise to our corporation and in the direction that they provide to us to be able to advance the project for Alaskans. We understand fully what our responsibilities are, and we have some new representatives that were recently nominated. Mr. David White, formerly president of Alaska Pipeline, also a process engineer, very knowledgeable about developments, project-related costs, and how to execute. Then we also have Mr. Warren Christian, again, who's a constructor. As president of Dorian Associated, he knows how to build pipelines in Alaska. So along with he and Mr. Cruz, we have the construction fields from both horizontal and pipeline construction well covered, and with the expertise that comes from both our transportation commissioner as well as Ms. Drygas, and certainly the labor representative with Mr. Merrick, we feel that we've got a good spectrum of Alaska covered, but with expertise and knowledge to be able to help push us forward.
Mr. Richards, before you go into this next section, I'd like to recognize Representative Chenault, who I didn't see, I apologize, here, who has been with us this meeting. Thank you for being here. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Again, as you recognize, Senate Bill 138 gives the responsibility to the project to provide an update every 4 months. And so this is our first opportunity after the handoff from the very competent Alaska project management team led by Steve Butt to be able to present to you, the legislature, how the project is moving forward and where we're going to go with it. And I would echo the sentiments that were provided by our former partners on the Acalogy project, but that project management team did do a very good job in terms of completing the work and handing over to us, and there was a very
well-executed orchestrated transition for all of the information, the culmination of $500 million worth of efforts that were undertaken and provided that to AGDC to be able to then advance the project. So very, very briefly, what is the Alaska LNG project? It is an integrated project, meaning its components from a Point Thompson pipeline to a gas treatment plant at Prudhoe Bay to a mainline pipe from Prudhoe Bay to South Central Alaska and an LNG or liquefied natural gas plant on the south side of Cook Inlet. It includes gas from both the Point Thompson and Prudhoe Bay units. That gas must be treated, though, in order to be able to get it to the specifications necessary to sell it as liquefied natural gas. So the gas treatment plant must be built on the slope to be able to remove the CO2 or carbon dioxide and hydrogen sulfide to be able to get it to that LNG quality spec. So that plant would sit on approximately 200 acres of site near to the gas compression and gas handling facilities currently on the slope, and that would be milepost zero of the pipeline. That pipeline would then run across from the north to the south of Alaska, essentially, crossing three mountain ranges with eight compressor stations to be able to deliver enough gas to be able to meet the liquefied natural gas plant designed to be able to output approximately 20 million metric tons per year of product. So, Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the Chair. I was wondering if you could give us an approximate cost for each of these three elements.
Yes, through the Chair, Representative Parrish. Essentially, in very straightforward language, the liquefied natural gas plant or facility represents approximately 50% of the project, with approximately 25% then covering the pipeline and 25% covering the gas treatment plant on the north slope.
Follow-up, Representative Parrish.
Thank you, and through the Chair. And in billions of dollars, ballpark?
Through the Chair, Representative Parrish, the outcome of the pre-FEED JDA was a cost estimate that the original range at the initiation of the project was $45 to $65 billion, and I'm happy to say that the work and the optimization done by the project management team has brought that down to the low end of that and below that low end cost range.
Thank you.
Representative Birch.
Through the Chair, I'd asked a question earlier about tariffs, and you know, we kind of live and breathe tariffs in this world. During the gas, we were looking at importing LNG in Anchorage, rather than having the lights go out at one point. And so tariffs are very important, and the cost of producing energy in Alaska is very high. The refinery that used to exist in Fairbanks that provided jet fuel forever, and it finally became cheaper to import jet fuel and land it in Anchorage, 3.5 million gallons a day that's pumped at Anchorage Airport. So my question, do you have any sort of a back of the napkin estimate of what the tariff might be for an end project that we would be constructing in this environment?
Through the Chair, Representative Birch, we are on slide 21, we give an indication of ranges of tariffs. And we'll get to that, if you may, in the commercial section.
Thank you. Thank you, ma'am.
Okay, please continue.
Okay, Madam Chairman, on the project status, again, with the joint venture agreement that we initiated in 2014 and terminated in 2016, that represented approximately $500 million worth of engineering, environmental analysis, design, field work, cultural resource, venture gathering to be able to understand what it would take to be able to build this project. So a lot of work done in the field, looking at wetlands, looking at cultural resource sites, a lot of engineering, looking at ways to process that gas, to be able to understand the ground conditions where you have a cold pipe crossing Alaska and discontinuous permafrost, looking at ways within the plant design to be able to be as efficient and cost-effectively as possible.
And that was the work that, at the conclusion of the pre-feed with the delivery of the 77 project deliverables that Bill McMahon spoke about, that is the work effort that has been undertaken to date. Now, all of that work product has been provided to not only AGDC, but also to the partners with BP, Conoco, and ExxonMobil. So at the end of 2016, there was a transition that was needed because we were going to be receiving a tremendous amount of data, tremendous amount of work product, 77 original deliverables, literally thousands of documents coming in from various work products in the various categories from environmental to engineering to process to design and safety related items. So the project management team at that time set up various transition meetings both in Alaska and in Houston, and we took the opportunity to get a better insight glimpse into what all that material was. So we did it both on the engineering aspects of the work, but also in the environmental aspects of the work. So the licensing team sat down with us almost daily and provided us with the information that they were representing in the resource reports and the feedback that they were receiving from the regulators. So that was important for us as we now take on this Federal Energy Regulatory Commission filing, that we have an understanding of the concerns of the regulators. That work represented approximately, in the resource reports, 33,000 pages of documents submitted to the agencies. So we needed to have an understanding then what that 33,000 pages represented.
Mr. Richards, if I might, in talking about this data transfer, would you say it's accurate to say, you know, one of our lessons learned through the AGEA process and the transition out of that was sort of who would end up owning the data as it, you know, became part of the new project. But Senate Bill 138 has specific language relative to that made this, you know, easier so now that all that information is available to continue the project forward.
Through the chair, I would ask Ms. Wilcox to answer that question.
Okay. And this is Lisa Wilcox, co-chair Tar. Would you clarify for me which section of the Senate Bill 138 you're referring to, just as far as facilitation of the data transfer or the data ownership?
I can do that. I need to get my notes. And I don't want to hold up our presentation, so we can come back to that point.
Yeah.
I just wanted to, for the new members, to understand that this is a significant piece of this to, you know, keep the work going forward, that all of this information is now made available, even though the leadership structure has just changed.
Okay, yes, and that is very true. I just wanted to make it clear that the legislation itself did not enable the data transfer. The data ownership was already, the data transfer from the pre-feed was already part of the pre-feed JVA agreement. However, the ability to use the data to further develop the project and to make regulatory filings was the part of the transition agreements that need to be negotiated that was accomplished over the last several months.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chairman, in that regard, the data that the state of Alaska, through the AGEA agreement with TransCanada, funded, AGDC is the recipient of that work effort as well. So we now essentially are the state's library for all of the work effort that was done with the Alaska Pipeline Project, with TransCanada and ExxonMobil, all of the work that we did internally with the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project, and now all of the work product that has been developed on the Alaska LNG Project. So that is a very large electronic library that we hold those assets to and we can use to advance our projects. So the design premise that we are continuing to work for, that $500 million, was again a three-train gas treatment plant on the North Slope feeding a 42-inch diameter pipeline leading to a three-train LNG plant. And that's the design premise that we're going forward with in our filing with FERC. And last point is we have unrestricted rights to that data, which is key. So our priorities in 2017, again, it is going to be reducing our regulatory risk. And what I mean by that is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is the lead agency that has the responsibility to
essentially license liquefied natural gas plants. And so our focus is going to be, as described by our producer, former producer partners, filing of that Section 3 application, which would ultimately give us the right to construct and operate a liquefied natural gas plant. So with that, though, we're also going to be looking very hard at the opportunities to reduce the overall cost of supply in the project through the various mechanisms of financing, but also look at optimization within the design process and engineering that has been done, but also in regards to the environmental regulatory regime that will be in place and how they will treat a sovereign in advancing this project. But we're also going to be focusing a lot of our efforts on our financial and commercial to try and bring down the cost and provide our project to buyers to be able to represent that we have a viable project, that it will only go forward if it is economically viable. And we will live within our means until we achieve a very major milestone that is landing of a project or providing project finance to be able to advance the project. So it's our year to make this project more competitively viable, to de-risk it in the regulatory regime, and to see customers to be able to provide this product to.
I believe Representative Johnson had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair. So if you have approval for, and forgive me because I'm not exactly sure how this works, but say you have the approval for three trains, treatment plant and your 40 pounds diameter line, decided to scale that back, say, and make it smaller, does that approval still stand, or would you have to?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, again, your question was, if we advance a project that is to the maximum extent, mm-hmm. and then we decide to maybe phase it, mm-hmm. bring on one train first and the second train. Yes, we will go through that process through FERC. What you're representing in this, in what will be an environmental impact statement, is essentially the worst case or the largest project that you will build. So you're identifying the impacts to the wetlands, the impacts to flora and fauna, the impacts to air quality, but also what the outcome will be in terms of the flow through that, because FERC has the responsibility, as I said previously, to license that plant to make sure that it's safe and operable.
Any other questions? Okay.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Vice Chair.
I'll wait for a wrap up. We're good. Sorry.
Okay, please continue.
We're doing okay for time, Madam Chair?
I think so, yep.
Okay. So why is FERC, and what responsibility do they have to Alaskans? Well, FERC, under the Natural Gas Act, has that responsibility, as I said, to permit liquefied natural gas plants and terminals. And so they must ensure that they're safe and reliable in the operations. That's their charter that they were given by Congress. FERC, though, comes to the table with a very comprehensive siting process, meaning that they have a tried and true method that they have used on multiple projects that has withstood legal challenges and been very effective because they follow this prescribed process. So that means that they will give you the guidelines that they want to have met by your submittals, and that once that you achieve that level of information exchange, then they feel that you've then met their minimum requirements, and they will then proceed forward through an environmental impact statement. So from the regulatory risk, that's a very good thing, because you know that if you achieve that level of competence and understanding and information exchange, you're then going to follow into a process that is very, very well prescribed. It will have a public process, but it'll be a shorter duration than you would normally see on other projects. NEPA is one law, but there are many practitioners of that law, and the time frames vary quite greatly across the board. They will be the lead federal agency that will ultimately develop the environmental impact statement for this integrated project. That means that they will have that responsibility, but they're going to be working in concert with cooperating agencies like the Army Corps of Engineers, the U.S. Coast Guard, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, etc., to make sure that they're going to put together an environmental impact statement that clearly represents what the project will be and its impact to the environment. Again, I reiterate that this is a very efficient environmental process with a very discrete timeline, which is helpful for large project to de-risk. So the three main focus areas that we have is what is known as the pre-filing option that is actually required by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. That is, a project is considered. You go to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and get their authorization to use this pre-file process, which is an opportunity to know what they want in development in terms of the resource reports, but it also allows you to have direct dialogue prior to going into the very formal process where it's ex parte and you have to be at arm's length in terms of communication. So it allows for a very good dialogue. It allows for a public process with public meetings not only by FERC but also by the project proponents. And we as the Alaska LNG project have done that across Alaska and outside. But the primary focus is going to be the development of these resource reports. The description of the project, the description of the environment, and the description of the impacts and mitigation to the environment. The first drafts have already been presented to FERC, and the comments have come back to us from those regulatory agencies. It's now our responsibility to adjudicate those comments and provide a revision to those resource reports that we'll then use as part of the application. Once accepted by FERC, you enter into the environmental impact statement process. They will utilize what is known as a third-party contractor to actually write the impact statement. That contractor costs are borne by the project proponent. So that contract has been in place with AKNG. We're rolling over that contract now to AGDC, but they are being directed by FERC. And what's most important is that from the usual time frames from application to completion of a draft EIS is 18 months. That's pretty astounding for very large projects. If you look at your transportation projects in the state, an EIS can run from years to decades. Okay. And so that's why I get excited when I see that FERC has this process. After the draft EIS, then we have a final EIS usually 6 months later. So very prescribed, 18 to 24 months to be able to complete this through a very well-defined but rigorous process that FERC has. The resource reports that I've referred to, there are 13 in number. On the right-hand side of this slide, you'll see the various subject matters that we must provide information on. There are 13, but only 12 have been submitted on this project. Why is that? Because number 12 of the 13 calls for information on PCV. I won't even try the acronym contamination, and there is none on this route or in this project, so we don't have to submit on that.
All right.
I had a question.
Representative Birch.
Yeah, through the chair, when it says number 10 alternatives, what does that embrace?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, for any environmental impact statement, you're as a proponent, you're charged with looking at what the alternatives to various to the project may be. If it's a pipeline route, and it's going to impact a wetland, you're charged with looking at alternatives impacting that, all the way including not doing the project at all. So, for instance, in this case, it's looking at air alternatives for routing leading into the preferred route now is down to South Central and landing at Nikiski. It will include an alternative looking at a route to Valdez. It will include a route looking through a route through Denali National Park. So all those alternatives must be considered and represented as to why those routes were not viable.
If I might, through the chair, yeah. The good representative from Juneau and I were chatting about at one time there was an over-the-top route. I think it was into the McKenzie River. Is that kind of off the table now, or are you? I mean, I just was wondering how wide you cast the net in looking for alternatives in this context. Is it just for getting that product to a market, or? And I just was curious as to how large that net is.
Through this process, again, through the chair, Representative Birch, many alternatives have been considered. Over the top, though, I think is statutorily prohibited. But I think I believe the Alaska State Legislature and even Congress maybe had written legislation to prevent that, and that was an iteration back in the 70s and 80s. Offshore LNG at the slope is a consideration. Again, the alternative of not going forward with this project was a consideration. Looking at potentially alternative locations for various plants is a consideration. So there's it's a very wide net. Again, the regulator in FERC in this case wants to make sure that they have asked the applicant to be able to represent what those alternatives are, so that if there is a legal challenge to the document, that they can show that there was representation and consideration.
Very good.
Thank you, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. So these resource reports, as we said, represents 33,000 pages of overall description, and not only to the flora and fauna and the engineering, but also to safety and reliability. That's where FERC's mandate to provide for a safe LNG facility under resource reports 11 and 13, they want very detailed engineering to be provided to them. And that engineering is held by FERC. It's not put into the public domain because it is, again, work efforts by the project proponent, and they review that or scrutinize that with third-party engineers to make sure that it's going to be a workable and reliable system. Now, we've talked about the response that we've received from FERC on those 33,000 pages. We've tallied 2,943 individual comments that have come back, and then it's our responsibility to adjudicate those in response and or modification to the regulatory document. So with the work that the Alaska LNG project management team assisted us with, we've identified three main categories: editorial comments coming in from the agencies, pre-FEED comments, which are essentially where some more work would be required to clarify the resource reports, and then FEED level comments, which would require further data and analysis that isn't necessarily required at this point in the environmental process. So those three buckets are being worked right now. We are working internally with our own environmental, regulatory, and lands team, but we're also contracting for some of the same resources that the Alaska LNG project had in developing that work. For instance, if it was on the question with regard to the liquefied natural gas plant and a plant design, then we're going to the designer, and that was Chiyoda. If it's on the pipeline route, then we're working with the contractor who was named Willie Persons. And if it's on gas treatment and we can't handle it with our own internal process engineers, then we're going to go to the gas treatment designer, which was AECOM. So we have resources in-house. We're trying to utilize those to the maximum extent possible. When we have to go outside to get that expertise, we're utilizing the folks that have the most knowledge and expertise in performing that work. So our focus over the next 6 months is, again, going to be adjudicating those resource reports, but then also completing a Section 3, Natural Gas Act Section 3 application. So the box on the right-hand side of slide 13 represents exhibits, 9 exhibits that must be provided to FERC in order for them to consider that the application is complete. And for those online, we include such things as articles of incorporation and bylaws of AGDC. It talks about a state authorization to be able to move forward on this project, safety and reliability statements, earthquake hazard and engineering analysis, the 33,000 pages within the resource reports, and then where those facilities are located. So that is a tremendous amount of work that we are anticipating completing over the next 6 months. We're targeting our application to FERC by June 30th of 2017. It's a little bit later than we originally had hoped to. And the reason for that is we weren't getting the responses coming back from the regulators in the timely enough fashion. We were hoping that they would come in October. We didn't get the final ones until January. And then we had this transition with AKLNG. So we are a little bit slower than we originally, but we're going to try and make up that time and complete the application. So for project execution, AGDC as a creation of the legislature, we've given the mandate to be a lean, lean machine. We are a very small but very competent organization that rely on contractors to augment our staff. We've been blessed with having very technical expertise provided to us, many by Alaskans that have worldwide experience in developing large-scale projects. But we need to augment that going forward because we haven't put in place the management systems for a large-scale project to be able to address the needs going forward on that. So we're looking to develop, again, a project management team which will bring in additional resources in a timely fashion. When the time is right, have the resources available to help us in advancing the project. Initially, it will be to help us augment the work with FERC, and ultimately, once we receive good commercial contracts, to be able to advance that project forward. So our approach, again, is we are looking for a strategic relationship with a lead contractor. In your turn will be, again, to support our FERC Section 3 application, but also to help us in looking at the existing project design concept and looking at the costs for ways that we can optimize those costs, bring those costs down to make the project more economically viable. But we want to make sure that we're taking the first steps, and that's avoiding delays. We want to de-risk the regulatory work to avoid future delays, and we'll get into the project target windows here in the commercial setting. But by reducing cost and schedule, we can implement a contracting strategy that allows for the normal process of front-end engineering and design to roll over into the execution phase. So we are going to be looking towards worldwide contractors to be able to bring in the expertise to be able to help us in managing this work effort. And the outcome of that will be that will then give some representation to the financial markets as well as to the commercial markets that we have the resources necessary to advance this project. We're going to live within our means. We're not going to go. We have the funding that's been appropriated to us by the legislature, and we're not currently asking for any additional funding in the next fiscal year. We're going to live within the funding that has been provided to us.
Mr. Richards, Representative Johnson has a question, and then Representative Birch.
So when you talk about having a lead, thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair. You talk about having, kind of looking worldwide for the right contractor, lead contractor, or bringing in large-scale expertise. Would you just speak to how that would, the way I'm looking at this, it sounds like you're talking about one contractor that would oversee the entire, you know, would be like your big general contractor. But and as much as possible, you would have one number that they would not go off of. As we know, if you've been in contracting, that's hard to keep from there being a change orders or however you say this on large scales like this. What does this mean to our local contracting businesses, to our in-state contractors, and how would you see them interacting on this project?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, very good question. In regards to the lead contractor, we're looking for someone that would have the expertise to act in the role of project management, program management, to be able to then provide and augment the staff within AGDC to develop the three primary sub-projects, the gas treatment plant, the pipeline, and the liquefied natural gas facility. In all conversations and by our enabling legislative mandate, it is to utilize Alaskans and Alaskan resources. So wherever we go, in our previous iteration with our partners, we were the voice of utilization of Alaskan resources to the maximum extent possible where economically feasible and viable. In this case, in our conversations, we are again addressing that Alaskans have resources, Alaskan contractors have resources, and are the ones with the knowledge and the expertise to work in the Arctic. And we want to make sure that we're not looking for someone to import. Commissioner Dryguess has made it very clear through her work with the previous our former partners and with AGDC that we must make sure that we have Alaskans trained and ready to be able to work on this project. So that description of
of the lead contractor would include the ability for Alaskan contractors to effectively work in this project. What we would be asking for from this lead contractor is, again, looking at lump sum turnkey type contracts. So they're guaranteeing that price and that schedule. So we're shifting risk onto those contractors. So again, we're in those discussions. We're looking towards the viability of that. And I would say that there are very keenly interested parties.
Thank you, Mr. Richards. Representative Birch.
Through the chair, Mr. Richards, you'd mentioned means a couple of times. Just because I haven't followed it that closely, what sort of a financial balance do you have? I mean, I've heard of $100 million at one time, but obviously some of those dollars are committed. But granted that there's no requirement for additional funding, but what would you see as the unexpended balance of uncommitted funds at this point within your department?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, the balance sheet, when the legislature created AGDC, they authorized us to have two funds. Those funds were capitalized initially with the funds for the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project, and that's called the In-State Natural Gas Pipeline Fund. Then in Senate Bill 138, they created the Alaska LNG Project and capitalized that with funds necessary to pay our share of the Alaska LNG Project. The balance of those two funds right now is approximately $104 million. So that represents...
Mr. Richards, we had trouble hearing you. Could you repeat that?
The balance of those two funds is approximately $104 million. So as we look towards the future and the needs to be able to accomplish the work, not only for regulatory, but in terms of financial and commercial, we're looking towards utilizing those funds to accomplish that. We are developing a budget that we'll be presenting to our board before the next board meeting to identify to them how we envision utilizing the funds that we have available to us, not only in calendar year 17, but in fiscal year 18. So again, at the initiation of this, we have not asked for any additional funds for fiscal year 18 in the budget process that we have right now. The one area that we have to come back for is asking for authorization of the legislature to expend the funds for the operating portion of our budget, which is personal services, contractual services, light and rent to keep an office going.
Travel
as well.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Co-Chair Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Richards, a couple questions. There have been some concern by some members of the legislature about the segregation of funds and whether funds that were meant to be used for House Bill 4 are being used for House Bill 138. I wanted to offer you this opportunity to sort of clarify your understanding of that, whether there's a misunderstanding, that sort of thing.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, again, when the legislature provided us with the funds and there was clear language in the statutes that identified what those funds could be spent on, we have complied with that. Funds that we use to develop the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project or the In-State Project came out of the In-State Natural Gas Pipeline Funds solely. And we have the accounting systems, and we are audited on an annual basis that identifies how we have expended those funds, and they look at the mechanisms that we use to do that. In Senate Bill 138, there was the creation of the Alaska LNG Natural Gas Pipeline Fund. That money was used primarily for the cash calls to pay for our 25% representation of the project. And then where we utilize funds from both fund sources is in terms of the operating costs of the department to pay for our salary, to pay for our travel, to pay for the light and rent of our office. We know full well that there's great concern about how funds will be used going forward, and we have a clear line of demarcation between those two fund sources.
A follow-up, Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The $104 million, to the extent you recall, are those funds that predate the current administration that remained available for AGDC's use from some prior appropriation, or are they appropriations that were made in, I guess, FY 16 and 17?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. Again, I'll speak to both funds. So the In-State Natural Gas Pipeline Fund was capitalized with that $355 million. To date, I believe we've spent approximately $135 million for advancement of the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project. The legislature in, I believe, maybe it was fiscal year 15, mm-hmm. appropriated $167 million out of that fund to cover education and needs within the Department of Natural Resources and Department of Law, maybe revenue as well. The funds that we have within the Alaska LNG Project Fund, some of that has been appropriated to us in fiscal year 16. There's fiscal year 15. I'm sorry, I'm going by calendar. But when the decision was made at the end of calendar year 15 to buy out TransCanada, funds were appropriated to AGDC for that purpose, but also for the purpose of funding the calendar year 16 expenditures for Alaska LNG. So funds have been appropriated within this last 2 years for that project.
Just one more, if I may.
Yeah, sure.
It's a slight segue, but not too far. On page 14 of your slide packet, where you talk about a lead contractor, can you describe for those listening in for the committee how you make decisions about who should be under the AGDC umbrella? That is, what type of worker and what skill set you want housed within your agency, and which exactly would be part of some new lead contractor, just so we sort of understand that division of labor a little better.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, again, on the chart, the area in the circle where we identify a blue box called Program Management Owner Staff. AGDC, again, I believe, has 22 position control numbers, or essentially employees. There are administrative folks, there are commercial folks, and then there are a couple technical folks. We augment those AGDC staff with Alaskan contractors. So that is the bulk of our project management team, is made up of experts with processing experience, with engineering experience, geologic experience, design experience. When I talk about bringing on a lead contractor, again, it's to integrate somewhat with that project management team, but the goal is to be able to have an owner's representative team, thin, lean, and mean, to be able to help drive forward the project to represent the state of Alaska. We're not turning over the keys to the lead contractor for everything. We are going to retain that oversight and responsibility to be able to be the owner for this project. Then that lead contractor would augment that team to bring in project controls folks, contracting expertise, maybe some expertise in environmental and regulatory to be able to help us in the FERC filing of the application, and other such areas. So it's a team approach, but again, ownership responsibility stay with AGDC.
Thank you.
Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, President Meyer, is it? We've talked about the construction of it, the management team thereof, and everything. Now, once it's built and we're operating, the state's not operating this. Is that correct? We have an operator that's going to actually function in that capacity for us? I don't mean we have one, but we plan on having one, or not.
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, the reason I'm looking quizzical, are you asking for myself or Keith Meyer to answer that question?
Chris
Meyer's
on the phone.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Meyer's on the phone, so this is Mr. Richard.
I don't care. I guess it doesn't matter who answers it. I was just wondering, plan on having an operator, not the state, run this.
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, I can say that, yes, we've developed a plan where operations will not be by the AGDC. We're going to look to be able to provide, bring on the expertise to be able to operate the system, the integrated system that we have to do that. That's going to be, when we develop the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project, we developed an operations plan to be able to advance that project into an operations phase. The previous iteration of this project with our partners,
that operations plan had not yet been fully developed, because again, it was going to be, what's it going to look like at the end result? State of Alaska, through the legislation to AGDC, has been, you're going to remain a very small entity. You're going to bring on the expertise necessary through contract to be able to operate.
Follow-up, Representative Rauscher?
I think so. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Vice Chair Wesley.
Yes, thank you. And through the chair, I apologize, Frank. Mr. Richards, I didn't recognize you earlier, and should have warned me. You dyed your hair a beautiful color.
Yes, thank you.
And you know, as I heard the talk about the budgets and everything else, first of all, I'm heartened. I mean, from what I'm hearing over here is, if you build it, they will come. You've got BP here, you've got Exxon here, and ConocoPhillips. This, it's encouraging to hear this stuff, because like many Alaskans here, when oil tanked and we had nothing else to sell, that was a bad feeling for a lot of us. So diversifying is always a good thing. Now, having said that, what I do have to wonder is, and again, it's the budget talks that came up, is where are these funds coming from? I'm hearing Senate bill things before my time. But, you know, for my constituency, and I'm sure everyone out here, is the question that's going to be out there is going to be, is this going to affect me? You're cutting my services already. You're cutting my PFD. Are you taking money from me? So, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Westlake, again, very good to see you. It's been a long time.
Yes, it has.
In regards to the finances of this, I will pass this to my colleague, Ms. Wilcox, who is prepared to talk about how we plan to finance it.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Westlake, the question of short-term versus long-term benefits for Alaska, of course, is in all of our minds at the moment. I think what AGDC would want to say is that from where we stand, this project appears to be extremely important in the long-term fiscal health of the state. But that is not ultimately our decision. That is the decision of the legislature and the administration. However, we will try to bring a project forward that carries those benefits all the way through to the state.
Thank you. And I know we have a couple slides in this section before we transition to yours. A couple comments for listeners and members. Just if you want to refer back to the original Senate Bill 138, it's Section 18. We're looking at Statute Section 35.25110, where the Alaska Liquefied Natural Gas Project Fund is created. And the previous section has the In-State Natural Gas Pipeline Fund. And a couple of other relevant sections, it's Section 21, of the bill that defines the Alaska Liquefied Natural Gas Project as a project that includes Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson and the associated infrastructure necessary. And then in Section 33 defines North Slope Natural Gas Project. So while AGDC has a lot of sort of authority to work within those parameters, it is defined, for example, relative to the question of Representative Birch, what the project is and what gas we're talking about. And so if those things are helpful, one to make sure to get those on the record. Please continue.
Madam Chair, again, moving on to slide 16, the value to Alaska for this project is really the monetization of the resource that is a proven resource. And so it is we call it a brownfield project. The gas is being cycled on a daily basis to be able to help with the oil production, and because there is no way to get the gas to market. But also the legislature gave us the responsibility to provide an access point for Alaskans to utilize this gas. So for Fairbanks, it will be, allowing them to reduce their reliance on home heating oil and get to have a source of natural gas that can drive down their costs considerably. But the outcomes of this project will be thousands, tens of thousands of jobs to be able to not only construct it, but then once the resource is in place with a mechanism to bring gas off the North Slope, it will allow for spurring more jobs for resource exploration and development across the North Slope and other portions of the state. So we feel that there are multiple benefits to Alaskans, and it's been a long time coming.
And then I'll end my talk before I hand it off to Lisa. Is again, our strategic advantage that Alaska has is again our proximity to those Asian markets that Mr. Bilbao of BP talked about. We're only 7 to 9 days from Japan and Eastern Asia. We are a proven supplier of North Slope gas through the 40-plus years that ConocoPhillips has been operating their plant in Nikiski. So we are a known resource, and so we provide also good political stability because we are a sovereign and we have the rights to be able to utilize our resources and market them. But as I said, it's also a proven conventional resource. So we feel this positions us well in the market and will allow us to be successful. And now, Madam Chairman, I will pass the update over to Ms. Wilcox.
Thank you, Ms. Wilcox. Thank you for joining us. And looking at the time, I'm hoping we'll have time to finish. And just want to keep in mind, if we don't, would you be available at our next meeting to continue your presentation on Wednesday? That would be?
On Wednesday, I can be.
Okay. Thank you. So for members then, I think this is probably where a lot of the questions are going to come from. So that's when I want to make sure we have time for that. So then I think we can, feel free to ask questions as you go along, knowing that if we have to continue into the first part of Wednesday's meeting, then we'll be able to do that. And we really appreciate you working with us on that.
Okay. Co-Chair Tarr and Josephson and members of the committee, for the record, this is Lisa Wilcox. I'm Vice President of Commercial Economics for Alaska Gasline Development Corporation. And since this is my first time recently presented to this body, let me give you a little bit of an introduction. It also gives me a chance to stammer through my introduction rather than the slides until I get going. I have been in Alaska for over 20 years, went to University of Alaska Fairbanks, and I have been in the Alaska oil and gas industry for about 18 years. Last time I presented to a body such as this, I believe was in 2011 when AGDC was presenting its initial project plan for the ASAP project in August of that year. Previously, I spent 12 years working for BP Alaska in various commercial roles, and including, as many of the folks in this room, on a previous endeavor to develop Alaska natural gas through the Denali pipeline project. So I have been a contractor with AGDC for the past several years and stepped into this role of Vice President for Commercial Economics in April of this year.
Thank you.
So with that, I'd just like to continue at first a bit of a global focus on where the LNG market is. Many of you have seen the slide before, but maybe some haven't. We are at the moment experiencing a global surplus in LNG. The LNG market is still a relatively low market, young market for natural gas in the world. And as you can see, it has experienced a period of tremendous growth. Through that growth, many of the projects have come online recently, and frankly, by some measures may have overshot. So you see a prevalence of spot market, that is the green area under the curve, that was not seen previously, and its prominence in the spot market in the LNG market is growing or has grown. And you also see that there was a the demand growth has slowed down recently, while at the same time the supply projects come on to and overcompensated for it. So that is one of the reasons for the current slump, if you will, in the market. Back when this chart was first presented, I believe the spot prices for LNG were landed in Japan were somewhere in the area of $6. Per a million BTUs, and now they have risen a bit over 7. But that short-term surplus is definitely still prevalent. Now, everyone also agrees in the LNG market that the demand will continue to grow. At what rate? Different people will give you a different answer, and all of it is just a forecast, so it will all be wrong in the end. However, yes.
Well, I was looking at your chart. I'm unfamiliar with MMTPA, and I'm just trying to understand both axes of your chart there.
Oh, Thank you. Thank you very much to the chair. Representative Birch, let me step back a little bit and explain the chart. So clearly on the bottom is the timeline, and on the left-hand side is a million metric tons per year, which is generally the measure of how LNG is exported. It represents capacity, overall capacity of the industry. This is, the slide is called Global LNG Balance. However, the chart is for Asian LNG supply and demand. So so the overall global demand is closer to, I believe, the 300 million tons per annum, or 350. It has grown quite a bit, so excuse me if I get that number wrong.
If I might, then, through the chair, then, so that's just basically LNG, produced LNG on the water. That's got nothing to do with gas that, you know, mom and dad are burning in the Midwest someplace. This is just,
that's right.
This is Asian marketed gas in a tanker that's been LNG cleaned up and chilled and all that stuff.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Birch, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So as you can see, the market can see how that supply will be taken up in the next few years by the continuing growth in demand, and the drop off that you see on the chart that starts in about 2021-2022 time frame is the lapsing of the long-term contracts from the key customers. So that's what we mean when we talk about the window in the market. So the contract demand is going to go down, and at the moment there are quite a few projects shopping that window, and the buyers are approached by many sophisticated parties.
Next.
The next slide is the global demand, and here we just wanted to show a sense of scale for the buyers by country that are in the market. The number of countries that import LNG has increased quite a bit in the last two decades, but you can see, as Mr. Bilbao mentioned earlier, the projected demand for China is very high compared to what it consumes currently and compared to other countries. Now, again, this is a projection. This is a 2025 projection, so they have a bit of a ways to go there. However, Japan remains the largest consumer of LNG and is expected to do so, although we can, you know, different folks will argue about the different growth rates and how much switching will occur from nuclear power to LNG and vice versa. So you can see the key charts there being, the key bars being, you know, China, Japan, Korea, that are both geographically and volume-wise advantaged for Alaska.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And through the chair, is this also a projection of Wood Mackenzie?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, this is not a Wood Mackenzie forecast. This is a forecast we received from our marketing team, and there will be an introduction of them in Houston later in the pack.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The next slide does. The data on the next slide does primarily come from Wood Mackenzie. And this is where we can start addressing some of the questions raised earlier by Representative Birch on the tariff. Now, let me just step back and explain the verbiage once before we get into this. Tariffs generally relate to pipelines. When we talk about tolls in the LNG industry, it means about the same thing. So tariff equals tolls for the broad purposes of the discussion. And when Wood Mackenzie first presented these charts, I would say a lot of the focus was on the bar on the left, and some of it was on the bar on the right when it came to the viability of receiving tax exemptions for the projects and their impacts. At least at least in the public, there wasn't a lot of discussion about really our key focus, which is the bar in the middle. Let me again explain the components of the chart. Wood Mackenzie, the way that they evaluate projects, they try to bring everything to the same common denominator. And that common denominator is a discounted break-even price for the project over its life. So when they presented this, what they meant by current project was a 12% overall return on capital, return for the project, and what would be the break-even price for it today, in today's dollars. So the range that you see that is represented by the dotted lines is that capital estimate of $45 billion to $65 billion. So that's what they took as the variable, and they said it could be as low as somewhere under 12 and as high as somewhere near 16. And this project was pretty much at the far end of competitiveness for on their presentation. I believe at the low end of $45 billion, there was still one that we beat, but not at the high end. So it's in their assessment, that was a bad situation to be in, considering the amount of supply, that is chasing the demand window. So when we talk about tolls or tariffs, just want to point out that all of these three charts have some common numbers. So those common numbers are the project cost estimate. So the project cost estimate ranges between $45 and $65 billion for all of these bars. The volumes are the same. The upstream development costs and returns for the upstream development are the same. But what brings tremendous variability into this is the cost of capital that is carried by the project. So when we talk about project finance and we're trying to bring the cost of capital down, essentially. We're trying to structure a project that has essentially promises from its customers to pay for the capacity that they reserve, and that allows the relatively inexpensive financing that will then find the investors that are looking for secure investment and the banks that will let those loans at low interest. So the engineering work that has been done on the project has a lot of influence on the tolls, but the commercial and financing considerations have almost just as much influence on them, and that is what we're working on now, and that we will work on.
Representative Birch.
Going back to the chair, the million BTUs, dollars per million BTUs, I can't remember the correlation between millions of BTUs and MCFs. There's a correlation there, right? Is it one-to-one or close to one-to-one?
It's very close. Through the chair, Representative Birch, it's very close to one-to-one.
So if we're talking, if gas is on the West Coast is $2 an MCF, that's close to using the same term as an MMBTU?
Hmm. That is right.
Okay.
That's right.
Great. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. So next we'll switch to, or this, after presenting kind of the big picture for this, we'll start talking about AGDC. These objectives have been presented by President Meyer a couple of times at least. And when we talk about operating as a corporation, I think what the emphasis here is that we will be a corporation that is responsible to its board, and our incorporation that is responsible to its board. We have been doing things in that area, such as the board has adopted several policies that were not in place before, and and we are a public corporation that is operating in an environment filled with private parties. So we have to make some allowances for that, but at the same time, we recognize we're a public corporation and we'll operate as transparently as we possibly can, and will be basically the state's window into the world of this project. I think we talked about most of these structure for third-party finance. You know, this is the work that we'll be undertaking this year, and in cooperation with BP and really other producers in their various roles, as well as the outside market. And our goal ultimately is to structure the project so that it can be financed at a low cost.
Representative Johnson has a question.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, looking back at the contract, the reduction in long-term contracts as page that was. So I'm trying to remember where I had heard this, and I was wondering if this is an AGDC position. So if the price for gas is correlated to the oil price by BTU output, mm-hmm. right? One of the ideas that I had heard is trying to get those contracts based on establishing a price that was stable, that you could enter into contracts for gas that wasn't necessarily tied straight to the oil price. Does this ringing any bells at all? Hmm. So I guess I'm trying to remember if that was that AGDC or a study that was done for you that talked about that, and could you just refresh my memory on okay. if it is on sure. how that would be?
If I may go back to the previous slide on this, through the chair, Representative Johnson, we haven't done a study on anything, and it's not. I don't think there's a body of work that mm-hmm. says the price of LNG has to be tied to one thing or another. Traditionally, LNG has been marketed as tied to oil and to the oil price, and you can see on this chart when it says 12 to 14% plus U.S. 80 cents per MMBTU, the 12 to 14%, it's a measure of pricing for LNG called a slope that is basically 12 to 14% of an oil price index. Now, traditionally, this was the case for LNG. Recently, with the emergence of the Gulf Coast projects, the price of LNG has been tied to Henry Hub, for example. There's been other pricing structures where the price has been tied to a tolling, kind of a synthetic toll. So a portion of it is tied to an upstream index, and a portion of it is tied to a toll. For this project, as you can see, a very large portion of our overall cost of supply is midstream. If we can shrink, because of how big it is, and because of how expensive, relatively expensive it is, I should say. So if we can shrink both the absolute of that and the variability of the price that Alaska has the potential to offer, it does have a potential to be more stable than others. Now, whether that's what Alaska will offer or not will depend on who's marketing the LNG, but there's that possibility, and I think that's one of our selling points as Alaska in general, is that the upstream is relatively more developed. There is infrastructure there. It exists. The gas has been found. It doesn't need, offshore platforms that need to be constructed. But the midstream is relatively large, but could be financed.
Thank you.
And just when we're looking at this, you know, upstream is in the sort of royal blue. Pipe and plant would represent the midstream, and then the downstream would be liquefaction represented by the last bar there.
That is actually shipping, the gray bar.
The little gray
bit is shipping.
Yes, no, shipping. Representative Birch.
On this slide on the right side, it says State of Alaska owned tolling utility, no tax. I guess as I'm sure the municipalities along the pipe alignment are paying close attention to the taxability and tax consequences. Does this model, or does that preclude the ability of a taxing entity, a property tax, for instance, on taps is like 20 mils for taps for anybody, for the property tax. Does this include, or this model include no municipal or local state taxes?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, I believe that is the case. When Wood Mackenzie was putting these numbers together, I think that the reason they actually wanted that bar in there is to show that even if you zeroed out every tax, it's the project would still find it challenging to meet the current market price. It was not to show that that is the way it should be done, but that was their motivation.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, ma'am.
Any other questions? Representative Parrish.
Am I correct in saying that the upstream price is, I'm sorry, through the chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. The upstream price is at a reasonable, commercially agreed upon terms, sale from the big three in particular.
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, what the upstream bar on Wood Mackenzie study represents is applying the same kind of 12% rate of return to an upstream project with their assumptions for what it would cost to develop Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson. So it's not a price. It's their assumption of what a reasonable return on the upstream would be.
Mm-hmm. And follow-up? Representative Parrish.
Thank you. And are we and our partners on the North Slope yet bound by contract to some price, or could we find ourselves tens of billions of dollars into the project and then they would have us over a pretty big barrel? When do we make that formal agreement for a formula?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, we do not have any current contracts with the upstream, but I would say that if AGDC or the state of Alaska is in a position of buying gas from the upstream, we would need to land those contracts far in advance of being tens of billions of dollars in.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions before we wrap up for today? Okay, we are on slide 21 in this. We will begin Wednesday's meeting with this slide, or slide 22, to pick up the rest of this portion of the presentation, again, under the umbrella of AKLNG update. And then we'll also have Mr. Terrio join us for the portion of the Senate Bill 138, which, when you look back at that section, required this report be delivered to the legislature by January 1st of 2017. So that is why we have just received this report, and we'll have the presentation by Mr. Terrio on Wednesday. And so with that, at 2:59 p.m., we will adjourn.